The record industry may be struggling, but in 2002, Dan Kennedy was pretty excited to leave the world of advertising and move to a major record label. His rock dreams didn't quite match his office life as director of creative development, coming up with ad campaigns for bands. His record industry career ended when he was laid off. He's written a funny memoir about that period called Rock On, an Office Power Ballad. He's also the author of the book Loser Goes First and is a contributor to McSweeney's. Dan Kennedy, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start from a reading from Rock On.
This is called I'm Paid to Write Love Notes to Phil Collins. Before we get to the first big assignment at the new, intense, high-profile rock and roll job, let me first admit that there is a delusion I have apparently quietly indulged since, say, age 30, and it's this: that I am still as cool as I was when I was 17. Inside the heart and head, a sort of suspended animation, a never quite acknowledged freezing of time. Unmonitored, this is how the tragedy of uncles who still get high happens. And now, having taken a full-time job working on the marketing and advertising of bands, somehow this delusion is raging in a very bad way. In the days leading up to the job, I've spent a lot of time laying on my couch, listening to my iPod and daydreaming about how I'm basically going to be paid to be some sort of intense, uber rock and roll person who is marketing loud, fierce, developing bands that are not yet registering on the radar of the so-called normal run-of-the-mill adults in the mainstream. Those were great, powerful, and beautiful moments of delusion, mostly because I had not yet sat down and faced this first big assignment, to write an inspirational and congratulatory ad campaign that celebrates 25 years of heartwarming love songs from Phil Collins. I've been told that one of the ever-changing co-presidents of the company wants to make sure I understand that my ad campaign is going to be targeted largely to females 40 to 50-plus years of age, so I need to be writing in that voice. The first thing I do is pace around the temporary office they've got me in, wondering how the hell I'm going to do this. I start trying to write some headlines that I think 40 to 50-something-year-old women can relate to. For some reason, they all sound like those Hallmark greeting cards that aren't really for any occasion in particular. Like, they're usually filed under a section called Just Because or Friend. The headlines go like this. Remember the first time you heard that special voice? Here's to the voice that taught us about love. Who was really your first love? In a quiet panic, I cut those headlines and I jump to adjectives like biggest selling, chart conquering, platinum smash, and then I land on the word hero. Yes, he's a hero. Okay, maybe not a hero, I think to myself.
And that's Dan Kennedy reading a section from his new memoir, Rock On, about doing marketing and advertising campaigns for Atlantic Records. Dan Kennedy, that was a great reading. So what are some of the ideas you did come up with for that Phil Collins campaign?
Well, you know, I kind of just entered this really strange, you know, area of my writing talent that I didn't know I had, which was to write these extremely emotionally vague notions about love and who taught you about love. And the clash of that, you know, to what I thought I would be doing, that was really day one on what I had convinced myself was going to be sort of like the front lines of the fierce rock and roll storm where, you know, I would be keeping it real, quote unquote. and I sort of fancied myself being this cross between like a really normal, you know, finally a normal, respectable person who, you know, went to an office and then home to loved ones each day and then back to an office and then home to a loved one. And I thought, oh, I'm finally going to fit in. But I also thought there will also be this kind of, you know, Henry Rollins-like quality about me suddenly that, you know, finds me just very, very dialed in and very, you know, not like the other 35-year-olds. And so to have day one sort of be, you know, trying to capture the voice of a 50-year-old woman, and I might mention being, like, chillingly good at doing it, was a little bit of a weird feeling. And so all the ideas I came up with were kind of like, you know, exactly those ones like remember love, you know, and, you know, wouldn't you like a little more love in your week and things like this. And I was just like, wow, this is odd. I'm really tapped into this, this experience of being, you know, a 50-year-old female. I'm really right here on the front lines of rock and roll, aren't I?
See, that's one of the scary things, to think that there is a generic 50-year-old female that anybody could, who's, there isn't one.
There really isn't one. But if you work in marketing long enough, people convince you that there is. You know, it's sort of a cross between like a General Foods International Coffees and you know, and a Hallmark card. You know, that would be sort of the tone, I think. But you know, in the end, the ad that they ended up going with was simply a picture of Phil Collins' face and the number 25.
Because it was his 25th anniversary of
his recording career. Yeah, and very simply they just said, oh, we're just going to use a picture of his face and the number 25. And at first I was kind of, you know, creatively outraged. I was like, why am I even here? This is all such a sham. Like, there's no writing craft in that. And then, of course, when I opened my mouth, what I heard myself say was, oh, that'll be nice. You know, that'll be an elegant way to go. Good, good.
At the beginning of that section, you talk about indulging the delusion that you're still as cool as you were when you were 17. And that's a delusion that I think many, many people inside and outside the record industry indulge in, if you ever thought you were cool to begin with. And I guess, like, did working in the inside of the record industry and seeing the bands and seeing the execs and writing directly to the fans make you rethink the whole meaning of the word cool anyway?
Yes. I mean, it was very much sort of a scared straight experience. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I would imagine for a normal developmental, you know, sort of thing that you would go through as a 35-year-old male, maybe you would gradually start realizing you're not cool and you'd start breaking it to yourself gently. But, you know, when you're in the recording studio with an all-female punk rock band who are all like 22 years old, you realize very quickly, like, oh, I'm kind of like the dad here. I'm kind of like the weird neighbor who, you know, doesn't know what's cool, who's using slightly wrong terminology, you know. I think that was the day it happened when I was, you know, recording PSAs with the Donnas from San Francisco, this great punk rock sort of guitar rock, all-female band, very, very cool and very hip. And, you know, I was sort of standing there in, like, leather shoes and a gray sweater and slacks and, like, trying to convince them I was cool, you know. And I just thought, oh, gosh, you know, something has happened since 1986 and it's not good.
Yeah, but at what moment were you cool? Because your first book is a memoir about being a loser. So where was exactly the time that you were cool?
Well, for a minute, I thought being on Fresh Air would go to my head, you know, like it'd be a bad thing. Feeling very well adjusted now. I think I was cool briefly. And, you know, if I had to be pressed and really honest, I was probably cool briefly in 1985. You know, that doesn't sound like the most boastful, confident thing. If I walked into a cocktail party, I might not open with that remark about myself. But, you know, yeah, honestly, I was probably briefly cool in the junior and senior year of high school for me.
Do you start to think about popular culture as always being about overthrowing what came before?
I think to some degree, and you also start becoming one of those people, like I started becoming very afraid that I was going to be that, you know, that guy who's like, hasn't been a decent record made since Sticky Fingers. You know, sort of a Simpsons character of yourself.
Yeah.
But you never quite wanted to be that person. And of course, yeah, you do slowly start to become this person going, oh, it's kind of all been done before. Like, I think that's why I started, you know, just getting way more into books really during that period.
What were some of the moments when the corporate setting and the music it was selling and promoting were most at odds?
You know, there's a scene in the book where I talk about being in a meeting where we find out that a song by Jewel, which is all about not selling out. It's a great song. You know, it's about following your heart and sort of staying true to yourself in this culture that is trying to always bombard you with advertising and media and different messages. But we were in this meeting finding out that we were going to license it in a like $120 million ad campaign for a razor for women, you know. And that was definitely ironic. I mean, I definitely remember looking around the room thinking, are we not, we're not supposed to say this is ironic, right? Are we supposed to, this song's all about not selling out, yet we're gonna, okay, I'm not clear on this, but I'll just keep my glasses on and look intelligent.
What's one of the ad campaigns or, you know, TV commercials that you came up with that you really liked?
I really liked, you know, I came up with a commercial for Fat Joe. This he's this rapper from the South Bronx, and I shot this TV commercial with Fat Joe that I thought came out particularly good. I think I have a special sort of spot in my heart for that commercial.
What was the commercial? What did you do?
I see where you're going. You really want to know the extent of the ideas I came up with. Here's where it gets particularly humiliating. Well, the big idea there, as I put it in my treatment, was that Fat Joe would be in the quote-unquote panoramic prime Manhattan real estate, looking like a hip-hop overlord in control of the scene. Camera would track through the surroundings, push up to the desk, and Joe would lean into the light and simply say the word loyalty, which was the name of the new album. And this, you know, first I have to say that I wrote this treatment sort of like really over the top. And I wrote it over the top just because I thought they'll never go for this. It's kind of crazy. And I also think I was kind of overcompensating for the fact that I'm just a your really normal average guy, you know, from the suburbs. And the worst thing happened is that, you know, my boss, Valerie, came into my office and was just all smiles going, he loves it. You know, we have to do it. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you know. But that was really the whole treatment. I mean, the whole script was, you know, we go into this sort of den of hip-hop righteousness and there's a shadowy figure sitting at a huge desk. And as the camera moves toward that desk, he leans into the light. We see that it's Fat Joe and he simply says the word loyalty.
My guest is Dan Kennedy, and he's written a memoir about working at a major record label, writing advertising and marketing campaigns, and his memoir is called Rock On, an Office Power Ballad. You have a great and very long light bulb joke in the book, and I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of it.
Excellent. Before we move on, a record business riddle. Question, how many of the likes of us does it take to change a light bulb? Answer. First of all, before we change anything, is the light bulb really burned out? Maybe we just need to breathe some life into it, repackage it. Maybe the light bulb could do a duet with somebody, Sheryl Crow, Tim McGraw, in hopes of getting some crossover appeal. Maybe it could be in a beer commercial. Maybe we could get it out on the road with a brighter light bulb. The other thing to think about is that this summer, Honda is rolling out a $100 million campaign for a new car aimed at 30-somethings who consider themselves adventurous and spontaneous, but can't really afford something like a luxury SUV, and it might be a perfect campaign to tie this light bulb into. At least it would be the perfect demographic in terms of age. Also, and this is just an idea, what if we found out what video games are being released in the third quarter and maybe pitched the idea of having our light bulb make an appearance in the video game at some certain level of completion? Like you get to a dark cave, let's say, if it's an adventure game, and if you have enough points, you can get the light bulb, and it would be our light bulb, obviously. And then it's easier to see in the cave. The other thing is this. Worst case scenario, the light bulb is, in fact, burned out. Is that really the end of the world? I mean, maybe that's actually of more value to us in the long run. Picture this for the voiceover. The light bulb is dead, but the legend lives on. Re-released, remastered, revealed. The light bulb in stores now. It almost makes more sense than taking the time to change it. Plus, if we can sell it without dealing with it, you know what I mean? No demands from it. No hotels, no road expense, no delays in the project from its end, etc. But like I said, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, just brainstorming. None of this is written in stone.
You quote, I think it was like the new chairman of the label that you work for saying something like, I don't tell people I'm in the record business. I tell people I'm in the business of delivering a lifestyle. Hooded sweatshirts and other merchandise. Merch that features various band logos, licensing soft drinks, everything. There's no limit to how this business will change and become a business of selling a way of living more than simply selling music. And I'm wondering, is that the direction you saw the music industry heading in? And if so, do you think it's a result of the fact that people are kind of giving up on actually selling music?
I mean, you know, it's funny. There's nothing wrong with music. You understand that it's not a tough time for music, because I got really tired of, you know, basically guys who were making a ton of money and had offices the size of my entire apartment telling me that it's a really tough time for music. But if you go out in whatever city, you know, you're in tonight, and you tell the 600 kids or the 100 kids or the 50 kids or the 2,000 kids lined up at the club to see their favorite band that this is a really tough time for music, they'll look at you like you're mental. You know, there's nothing wrong with music. The only thing that's wrong in the music business is, you know, basically the consumers and the fans caught on to the fact that, you know, they've kind of been getting a weird deal at $20 per CD for three good songs and some fillers type of thing. So in terms of, you know, what people said in that environment, like that quote about, you know, we're now going to be in the lifestyle business. One thing I learned is that I could probably really succeed in a corporate environment if I could just say incredibly vague things with a straight face. You know, like if you could just sort of be like a smart, casual dressed beat poet, basically. You know, for someone who's making, you know, $7 or $8 million a year, actually it was our new boss whose contract was $50 million a year, which just sounded like a joke amount. And then that speech he delivered about, you know, we're not in the music business, we're in the lifestyle business. I just thought, gosh, if I could say things that sort of random and vague, you know, while looking good, I would be so successful in this corporate environment. You know, if people just said, like, you know, Dan, what do you see as the problem, you know, that's facing the music industry today? And I could say things like, I don't see that there's a problem as much as I understand that lifestyles are around us and that the air we breathe is the inspiration. So now more than ever, we're going to reach for the air. You know, but I always, you know, if you make enough money and you're in a big enough position, you say things that are just weird and vague and whimsical, and people are like, oh, yes, it's very much the emperor's new clothes. You know, it's just very much like, yes, that is brilliant, sir.
Dan Kennedy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure.
Dan Kennedy's new memoir is called Rock On, an Office Power Ballad. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.